I'd like to ask all of our people to join me in turning your cell phones and your pagers and your PDAs off and your laptops. It interferes with the with our electronic system up here, so I'd appreciate if you would if you could do that now. So don't be embarrassed. Go in your purses, in your pockets, and turn your cell phone off for us. And I'd like to ask each of you, I'm not good at stopping people, but I might have to if you go longer than 3 minutes. And if you have written testimony, I'd like for you to condense it through just talking to us and tell us, because you're going to give us the written testimony to read anyway. And that would be real nice of you. In 3 minutes, curtailing your conversation would be great for us, too. If you have handouts, bring them to the gentleman that is sitting on this side. That's Eric, who's the committee assistant, and he will help facilitate getting that information to us as you come up. So I'd appreciate that, if you will. I want to apologize for keeping our public waiting. We have very serious meetings in terms of trying to do the people's work, and so I even begged out early. We weren't supposed to start until 1:30, so forgive me for holding your time up, because I do really, really respect that. So I'd like to call Ms. Joyce Padilla and Roger Williams. I saw you, Dennis, but you came in late, and I had already told these people, but I thought you weren't here. My apologies. You'd be nice. Good to see you.
Sir. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Roger Williams. I'm on the board of Ocean Network, which is a homeschooling, statewide homeschooling organization. I was talking with Senator Morissette this morning, and he suggested that I come and talk with you folks about the problem that we're having. It used to be that foster parents could homeschool foster children. A few months ago, the Department of Education looked at the homeschool statute and reinterpreted it such that foster parents can no longer homeschool foster children. They're technically within their rights there, because it says that a parent or a legal guardian can homeschool a child, and they decided that a foster parent is neither of those, so they can no longer homeschool. So how it's worked is that the Department of Human Services makes a determination whether the child should be homeschooled, and then arranges that with parents who are foster parents who are willing to do that. So it's all under the control of the department. The Oregon Foster Parents Association has drafted a bill, and Representative Flores is going to drop it on the House side. We have drafted the same bill, and we're going to drop it on the Senate side with Senator Starr. What this bill does is, every place that it says a parent, it says foster parent. It adds foster parent in there, so the foster parents, it's legal for them to do it. The department can still decide whether or not, and it's not now impossible with this language. So,
thank you. And I've been asked to come and talk to you also on regards to this. I'm Joyce Padilla, and I am a foster adoptive parent. I fostered out of Polk County and also fostered with Marion County. I also serve on the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, or OCHA Network, that Roger is with, and have a history of over 20 years of homeschooling. And I've also had the privilege of homeschooling foster children in the past, and presently are homeschooling foster adopted children. Just wanted to address to you why I believe that I would like to ask, and why this bill is important, is that we want it to be a viable option for children to be able to be homeschooled, along with the option of being able to be in public, private, or charter school. Many of these children that come into state care are coming in with fetal alcohol and drug effects. They have often have attention deficit issues, attachment issues, abuse issues, and much more. And because of these issues, they're emotionally younger than their chronological age and often have academic delays. And I've seen, by being able to homeschool these children in the past, I've seen the benefits of taking a child who has these issues and putting them in a quiet, stable environment with low stimulation, meaning there's not a lot of visual or auditory stimulation going on around them, and seeing them thrive and benefit from that. These children often are children who have a slow processing ability, and yet if they're in a classroom, whether it's private or public, they're often expected to respond rapidly. They have memory problems, they have trouble remembering or retrieving information, and yet they're expected to remember everything. In a homeschool setting, they're able to do a lot of repetition, a lot of review that often isn't able to do in the classroom. They often learn best by doing, where often in classroom it's expected that of them to learn by hearing. They often have trouble transitioning from one task to another, and in the classroom setting there's multiple transitions. They are multi-sensory learners, and in a classroom usually the instruction is geared to often whatever the teacher is most comfortable doing and not necessarily meeting the needs of the child. They need more time to complete a task, and in a classroom again it's one timeline for all students. So what we have seen and what I've witnessed in by homeschooling these children is that you're able to address their needs. You're able to slow down, take the time it needs to meet their needs. And these children function well with routine, repetition, and structure. And you can offer that with home education. And I would add that not by adding this, the foster parents that homeschool doesn't mean that every foster parent is going to want to homeschool their children. Not every foster parent will even want to consider that as an option, because already you're taking a child into your home that has many, many needs, which is a lot of work. And you might ask, well, why would anyone want to home educate a child when you're already taking on a huge task just by taking them into your home? And I can assure you that anyone who home educates isn't doing it out of convenience, but they're doing it because they believe that it's in the best interest of the child. And it is work, and it's a lot of work, but it's the rewards are huge. Because by homeschooling, it allows the parent to address not just the academic needs of the child, but the emotional needs of the child as well. It allows you to teach them life skills that they'll carry the rest of their life. And lastly, I'd just like to say that just like a personal example, we had a little boy who came to our home. He was 5 years old. Within a few months, he was going to turn six. We were his seventh foster home he'd been in. And he was, we were told that he had aggressive behaviors. He'd been expelled from kindergarten prior to coming to our home. I know, you think, what do you have to do to be expelled from kindergarten? But he had been expelled from kindergarten. They asked us if we'd take this little boy, and we said we would if they allowed me to homeschool him. This child was in my home for a year and a half before he was adopted into another family. And I might add, we stay very close to this child today. I mean, he's still part of our family, even though he's adopted into another home. But in a year and a half, this child went from being a child who, when he came to us at five, almost six, he couldn't put full sentences together, so he couldn't communicate with words well. He did not know his ABCs, so his 1-2-3s. He didn't know the difference between up and down, frontwards or backwards. And we began to work with him in our home. I began to work with him. I have older children in my home. They worked with him. I have older biological children in my home and my husband. And in 18 months, he was there in our home. The caseworker said, we had transformed this child. But what had happened, we brought him into a stimulation, a home that wasn't overstimulating to him, a home that was structured around routine, and he functioned, he thrived on routine, we were able to meet him where he was at. And when he left our home, the child is functioning at third grade level, and he's continuing to do well in his present home. But it wasn't because I'm such a wonderful teacher, but it was because we were meeting his needs where he was at. And many of these children, this is what they need. And it takes a special person to meet those needs. And what we're asking is just that those who are willing to step forward and meet the needs be allowed the chance to do that by allowing parents to homeschool the foster children. Thank you.
Thank you. Deb Barber and Dennis Morrow.
Madam Chair, may I ask Mr. Wings?
Or Williams. Mr. Roger Wings. Wings.
Could you say again the name of the legislator who is sponsoring the bill?
Representative Flores on the House side and Senator Starr on the Senate side. I have the Senate LC is 2861. I don't have the House LC.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Excuse me, for just one moment. Senator Farioli is here. If you don't mind, don't do say the word. Senator Farioli called and asked to be the first question. He was here, and I was late in the meeting, so my apologies, Mr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. State Senator Ted Farioli, Senate District 30. And may it please the court, I would like to add something to the record and to keep a promise that I made to the social service assistance personnel that visited my office last week. I know that many of you were visited by folks from the social services assistance and from the child welfare department of the Department of Human Services, and they came attired in their usual purple t-shirts, and I think they filled the building up, and I was able to meet with about three flights of folks, and they really wanted to be here to provide testimony today themselves, but their schedules will not allow them often to travel to Salem. So I made them a promise, and that was to deliver their testimony to this committee. I found their testimony to be compelling, and I'll tell a little story if you don't mind, Madam.
Not at all.
These folks are concerned that the SSA positions are going to be consolidated or eliminated in the effort to make more efficient and to cut costs in the Department of Human Services. And while I don't have any argument with the management of the Department of Human Services in seeking to do those things, I think it's really important that we convey the information about what it is that these folks do and why their services are valuable, so that you can put those things into kind of a perspective when you're making these decisions. The SSAs are folks that provide direct support to the folks that work in the child welfare system. They provide transport. They are empowered with a spots card to make special purchases on the spot for the children's benefit, or to provide supplies or needed materials that either the court or the CASA or the caseworker have ordered to be delivered to the foster parents or to the child. They observe visitations if those have been ordered to be observed. They just provide a whole series of support services in the role of their social services assistant to the caseworker. And when you look at the areas in rural eastern Oregon where caseworkers need to go, in my district it's tens of thousands of square miles. And the choices that we have to make in this instance are to recognize that the social service assistance personnel are the folks that do the legwork. You know, they drive the rigs, they deliver the kids to visitations or to doctor's appointments or to counseling services, and make those kinds of connections. And if they didn't, if they weren't available to do that, then the caseworker would have to do that. So the real question that we have is, do we want the caseworker to be supported by social service assistants so that they are managing the case and doing sort of the command and control administrative services that have to happen in that office to make sure that the court orders are followed, that the best interests of the child are observed, and that we do the best we can do for the best interest of the child, either to reunite the child with the family or to make sure that the counseling objectives get met and the educational and health objectives get met. And so the choice is very simple. We either have the SSAs out there doing that work or it doesn't get done, or it falls on the caseworker to do that work. And so I would just point out that it may be a more efficient use of our resources to make sure that we have the kind of support services that we need out there so that the folks that have the training and are involved in that casework don't end up driving cars and doing the observations that maybe would take them off work of a higher priority. The folks that visited me were Chris Barrows from Elgin, and she is an SSA in child welfare at the department. She's had 8 years' experience. And Kathleen Cordell, and she works in Union County. She is a CPS worker in Union County. And we're providing copies of all these letters to you so that you have them for the record. Brenda Levitt from LeGrand made the trip over. Mickey Vickers has come over. She is writing in support of the local SSAs. Susan Hughes is an adoption specialist in Union and Wallowa County. Jennifer Grandheffer is a DHS child work caseworker. Travis Amherty is an assistant SSA. I'm sorry, an SSA with the DHS. Mark Perry is at the Union branch of the DHS, working in child welfare. All these folks either are directly connected as parents or SSA workers or child welfare workers in some part of the system. We just wanted to make sure that their voices didn't get lost in this process and that they had an opportunity to have the information conveyed directly to the committee members. And so I was honored to be able to do that today. Susan Lemon, foster home certifier in child welfare, and Dolores Valdespino, who is an SSA. So in Union County. So this, these folks are scattered across rural eastern Oregon and sometimes the remotest areas of the state, even those that have the designation of frontier. And it just seems to me that although we may save some money by eliminating those positions and consolidating their duties up to the caseworkers, in the long run, we really are going to be eliminating an efficiency and probably using resources that you really can't quantify in terms of dollars, because a lot of the services that are currently provided either don't get provided at all or they get provided by somebody in a much higher pay grade. So that's sort of the information I wanted to bring to the community.
Senator, I really appreciate you doing this, because you actually just spoke for 10 people from rural Oregon, and Ms. Foley is here, and so I'm sure she heard very much the information that you entered into our records today, so thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and the rest of the committee, and I'm sorry to have derailed the testimony of these folks, and I appreciate the courtesy of being allowed to make my testimony for the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Mr. Morrow?
So I'll start off. I'm Doug Barber, here today on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. The Alliance is made up of 33 member agencies across the state. Included in the materials we hand out is a list of those agencies. You'll probably recognize many of the names from your communities. Last year, these agencies served 78,000 children. including child welfare, contracts, Oregon Youth Authority, mental health, and others. To serve those youth, our member agencies employed 3,800 staff people. Our specific interest in the child welfare budget is on page 112 of the packet that you've been working with this week. That's the it's policy option package 102-21, the behavior rehabilitation service rates increase. The private nonprofit agencies that provide these BRS services are innovative and effective. The programs deliver quality outcomes that help abused and neglected children and youth reunite with their families, complete school, and prepare to join the workforce. These nonprofit agencies also make a significant investment of private dollars in these programs. Last year, our member agencies raised $20 million in the community to help enhance these services. But for the private sector to continue to produce this solid return on investment, state contracts must move closer to reflecting actual costs. In 2005, the Children's Alliance hired a Seattle consultant to do a wage study comparing what our member agencies can pay their direct service workers to the average in the Oregon Wage Index. What they found was a 30% wage gap. That's just wages. That's not benefits, just wages. That has resulted in turnover rates as high as 67% in some of our member agencies. We're also beginning to see agencies turn contracts back into the state. Also included in the handouts is a letter from Homestead Youth and Family Services, which is a program based in Pendleton. Earlier this month, they notified child welfare that they would be turning back their BRS contract as of the 22nd of March. They can no longer afford to continue to subsidize that program. Homestead will continue to will keep its OYA BRS contract. And the difference, if you look at the last paragraph of the letter, the difference in payment in that contract is about $5,000 per child per year. We also heard this morning, Dennis and I were on a conference call with some of our members. Looking Glass in Eugene just laid off two of its child welfare workers and is looking at the potential of closing its program in June. The $2.6 million that you see on that policy option package in the governor's budget would raise the CAF BRS rate up to where OYA is currently. I know you had some discussion about this yesterday. In the OYA budget, the governor's recommended budget has a significant rate increase for the BRS services to try to bring those closer to cost. For child welfare to match that new OYA rate would require about an $8 million general fund, $14.9 million total fund investment. We think it's an investment that's well worth making in these very difficult children. And here today to talk more about the specifics is Dennis Morrow from Janus.
Madam Chair, before we switch, may I ask you a question, please?
Can I have you just for 1 minute to allow Senator Ferrioli to put something on record? I'm waiting for you to put this on record.
Well, Madam Chairman, I apologize to these gentlemen for interrupting their testimony. It's pretty nearly inexcusable if I wasn't so enthusiastic about their program. The reason that I wanted to bring the testimony wasn't that those folks had come to see me in my office. They came to see you in this committee.
Right.
And they had gotten up at 4:30 in the morning, and they'd gotten on a bus in La Grande, Oregon. And they'd come all the way down I-84 and down to Salem. And they made their trip designed to be in time for the committee hearing. But the day that they arrived wasn't the day that was scheduled for you to take testimony on this issue. So I just wanted to make sure that their testimony got into the record and that you recognize that it wasn't easy for them to get here. They they virtually spent a day on the bus to get here and drop this testimony. So I thought that was an issue that I should have mentioned earlier. Again, I thank you for the opportunity. Ted Ferrioli, Senate District 30. I beg your pardon, gentlemen, for the interruption.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your endorsement of this funding request.
Leave it to a lobbyist to accept every minute. Senator Gordley. And then Senator Kotek, may I please remind you that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have 17 more people between now and 2:30. Senator Gordley.
I will hold my question and I'll see you later.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Mr. Morrow.
All right. I will use only 3 minutes and 34 seconds, so you won't have to even time me.
Well, you 34 seconds, 2 minutes.
All right. So, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Dennis Morrow. I'm currently Executive Director of Janus Youth Programs in Portland. We're one of the largest adolescent service agencies in the state. We have 20 programs at 15 different locations serving runaway homeless youth and child welfare and OIA youth, as well as 3 programs in the state of Washington. I have 180 kids that sleep with me every night because they don't have other homes to go back to. Janus has BRS contracts with Oregon Youth Authority. We have BRS contracts with the state DHS, and we also have BRS contracts with the state of Washington. And we serve a total of 55 boys and girls every day in community shelter or residential care through those contracts. I was also part of the original planning team for BRS and have been part of the rate model as we've developed it over the years. And I want to just start briefly with some history. I think the most important part of the history is that when the BRS system was designed, we looked at with the state what the rate should be in order to afford the cost of care that the state was asking for, and then the state, and then we funded what was available. We took the money that was available to buy the package that was that had already been predetermined. That was a 30% discount off of the top. When BRS started, we started 30% in the hole. Since then, we have consistently not received cost of living increases up to 4 or 5 years at a time. I have had staff at Janus that last year, thanks to the legislature last year, we got our first CPI. That was their first salary increase in 4.5 years. People working with us and working with these kids.
I'm an old timer and mm-hmm. I know what BRS is.
Okay.
I'm not sure these new people know what it means.
BRS is a federal funding form of behavioral rehabilitation services, and it's the way that the state funds most of its residential and some of its shelter, but most of its residential care.
I knew about the program. Right. I was going to say,
Senator Gordley and I knew about that.
Right, no, I just didn't want to use acronyms. BRS.
Behavioral rehabilitation. Okay, there we go. Okay. Now, at the same time that the staff have not received increases, part of the reason for that is our hard costs, as Doug has talked about, has continued to go up. This year alone, we have a bid from our health insurance carrier that our health insurance will go up 20%. So if we want to keep health insurance for staff, which we would prefer to do, that means we either lay off staff or hold or reduce their salaries. After they got a little bit of money, we're going to have to end up taking it away. The result, and I want to be clear about this, is that I'm not here for Janus or for me. I'm here for these people. We have balanced the services to the hardest children in the state on the backs of people that care enough about it to basically work at a poverty-level wage. Right now, Janus starts people in our DHS programs that provide 24-hour care for these youth at $9 an hour. That's about $18,000 a year, not even enough for a single person to live on, much less support a family. The very same qualifications for an entry-level position in the state would pay $14.60 an hour. In other words, my workers can leave me and go to work for you and make $11,000 a year more, plus PERS. And oftentimes that is now the decision that they're making. We routinely place youth at Janus. We work with older youth, 17 up to 24 in some cases. We are routinely placing youth now in jobs where they are making more than the staff who are caring for them. And in fact, I did a little wage study of my own, and I found out you can make more as a Pizza Hut driver, you can make more as a garbage hauler, and you can make more as a cage cleaner at the Oregon Zoo than you can in the profession of caring for the lives of children 365 days a year. I'm not here to whine about being underfunded. I want to be clear about that. I'm here to advocate that all of us wake up to some startling realities and work together to address them. And I feel like DHS and OIA have been very supportive of us working together toward this. The three realities I'd like to end with. Number one, BRS programs are facing the highest turnover rates we have ever had in our history. Janus hired 36 staff in the last 6 months. A third of those staff left before they completed their six-month introductory period. We hired 36 new staff, a third were back out the door.
Wow.
And when we get our exit surveys, the primary reason is higher wage jobs, period. They come in when it's the only thing they can get. As soon as something else appears, they're back out the door. The second impact that's having is positions then are staying open longer. Our current world record is we have one night position in a Washington County program that's been vacant for 7 months. What are we doing? We pay overtime to other staff. that's more wages for them, but it burns them out. Or we have supervisors and managers, and I have program managers working nights and weekend shifts in programs because we simply can't find people to even come in and take the job. And the reality three is that I want you to understand Oregon is a leader, but unfortunately we're a leader going in the wrong direction. We have contracts with the state of Washington for BRS. The Oregon BRS system was modeled after Washington State. A team went up and looked at Washington and said, this is what we want to replicate. The difference is the contract I have with Washington State pays me $66 per day per use more than Oregon, 51% more. $2,000 a month more, $24,000 a year more for the same child. Janice right now is $70,000 in the hole on our two DHS programs that we operate under this system midway through the fiscal year. That will put us over $100,000 in the hole by the end of the year. We will be one of those agencies that have to seriously consider, can we keep doing the business? We are able to because I basically balance it on the backs of the Washington State kids. If I can have two or three Washington kids in Oregon, I can afford to provide Oregon kids the treatment that they need, and that's the only way it works. The catch-up COLA in the governor's budget won't get us where we need to go. That catching up to OIA is where we need to go. But that catch-up COLA at a minimum is essential to keep these programs alive so we can have the ongoing discussion of
can
what else
take
we do.
30 seconds more?
I'm there.
Okay.
So I hope you will ask not if these programs need more money, but rather ask if it were one of your children in these programs, and I've had kids through my adoptions in these programs. If it were one of your kids in these programs, would you settle for marginally funded care? My hunch is if you sent your child to get brain surgery, you wouldn't look for a discount surgeon. My hunch is if you sent your child for dental work, you probably wouldn't even look for the cheapest dentist. And my guess is you probably wouldn't even send them to a hairdresser that didn't have some kind of formal training. Please join with us not to find fault or blame, but rather ensure that Oregon's most vulnerable children are worth at least as much as pizza, garbage, and monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's more of something that you could provide us. I would like, and maybe this is a question for OYA, I'd like to get an understanding of the population served. If Homestead's serving both BRS and OYA, I assume they're not substantially different in terms of they're in different systems, but there's no justification for the difference in pay based on what they're providing, or maybe that's my assumption. So if we could get some information about the population, that would be helpful.
It's a fairly similar population, and exactly same menu of services and the same level of staffing that's mandated by the rate and the same level of qualifications for those staff.
Thank you.
Just briefly, I do want to acknowledge the work and the heart of Dennis Morrow. I've known Dennis for at least a couple of decades, probably going on three. And he's one of a handful of people I know, and there are many more, but people who have given their life in service to children. And I just want to honor that and honor you today. And it's good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would say after you live with eight children, waiting in line is normal for me, so it didn't bother me.
Thank you. And in the letter, Mark McKinney, is that his name? Yes, McKinney. Okay. Lisa
Good afternoon, Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm a social worker at the Juvenile Rights Project. To my left are two of our staff attorneys, Lisa Kay in the middle, and Amy Miller to the far left, my far left. We want to talk to you about several priorities of ours in the child welfare arena. You're receiving our handouts right now. On the front is an overview of some of our top priorities that we would like you to consider as you're looking at the child welfare budget as a whole. Those include payment for all relative foster care parents, which Ms. Miller will cover, the system of care flexible funds that meet the needs of children in the foster care system, educational stability for children in foster care, and the special rate cuts that are proposed in the governor's budget, and I will cover those two things in my time. testimony, and I'll start off. I also wanted to go on the record that we also very strongly support a couple of the other POPs that you've heard about this week, in particular the drug and alcohol treatment resources for parents that will help parents keep their children and keep them out of the child welfare system. And also the additional funding that you've heard about several times to increase the number of caseworkers and therefore decrease their caseloads, and at the same time increase the number of supervisors to decrease the number of caseworkers that each supervisor needs to supervise. So I wanted to start off with that. Another proposal that we strongly support is the $721,000 to pay for transportation to ensure that children can return to the school that they have been attending either before they enter foster care or as they move from one foster home to another. Most of the members sitting on the committee today, those of you who were here last session, voted overwhelmingly for House Bill 3075 last session. That changed the law related to residency for school districts, and it allows a juvenile court judge who reviews the case of an individual child to find that it's in the child's best interest to remain in the same school. The other part of that makes that possible is that DHS is then obligated to provide transportation under that law, but as it's written, their obligation only exists when they are given the money to provide the transportation by the legislature. So it's very important that you appropriate that $721,000. In the first three semesters that this bill has been in effect, the first year and a half, 250 children have been impacted by this law, according to DHS. About 45 of those are our clients, and we know directly how important it has been for them to remain in the same school with the same teachers, the same friends, the same support system that they're familiar with to help them through very difficult times. In regards to the special rate cut, I know I don't have a lot of time, and I would just urge the committee to look very closely at this proposal. Special rate foster care funds go directly to the foster families to meet the needs of special needs children. They're children with mental health disorders, with developmental disabilities, and with physical disabilities. They support foster parents who have nursing backgrounds, who have other skills and expertise that make them capable of caring for very high needs and challenging children. I don't think we're anywhere near having too many resources going to meet the needs of these children. Therefore, I really have to question giving up $7.5 million, the majority of that federal funding that would otherwise be going to care for these children. We agree there are some inconsistencies and inequities in the way this money is appropriated, but we cannot see that there is $7.5 million that is wasted in going to those families. And even if there are some families that are perhaps receiving too much, there are probably many families that should be receiving more. There are some counties where there are no families receiving special rates, and there are probably some of those families who should be or should be receiving more. So we would like you to examine that proposal very carefully, and I'm very concerned about foregoing those federal funds, the matching funds, especially in the current climate, where if we forego federal funding when we decide later that it would have come in handy, we may not be able to get it back again. So I don't know that it's worth saving $3 million in general fund to forego that special rate money coming from the federal government. Finally, just leading into this case testimony on flexible funds, I wanted to direct your attention to this chart. It's on the back of your third page, I believe, in the packet. This shows the trends in terms of flexible funds appropriated in different biennia for the needs of children and their families, and then the ending amount, the legislatively approved amount that was left by the end of each biennium. And you can see that these funds are significantly less than we had in the 97 and 99 biennia. I will also point out that those funds did not cover all 36 counties in those biennia because the system of care was rolled out over an eight or nine year period. And so in 97, only half the counties in Oregon were covered with that money. And in the 99-01 biennium.
Can I just stop you for a minute? We have people come long distances, and I really, really would ask that those that come behind you, please respect the 3 minutes. We have actually 15 more people to go, and we have 30 minutes to do it.
Okay. So with that, I will turn you over to Ms. Kay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Kay. I'm an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about the child welfare budget. I'm going to be talking about a piece of that budget, which is the flux funds. As an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project for the last 10 years, I provided individual representation to children served by the child welfare system. My current clients are ages 3 months to 20 years old. All my clients that I serve currently are in foster care. Many of my clients have tragic and terrifying stories of abuse and neglect, acts that were perpetrated by those who should have cared and loved for them more than anyone. Part of my job as their attorney is to hear their stories, such as my 5-year-old client who acted out for me how his stepfather burned him with cigarettes, or how couple of very young siblings that I represented who were 3 and 4 told me about how they tried to wake up their mother when she was passed out from using drugs and they thought she was dead. Or how a teenage client described for me how her extremely mentally ill mother tried to kill her in a brutal attack. But my clients, in addition to these stories, also have stories of hope and healing. These stories of hope and healing are made possible by the provision of flux funds. Flux funds buy specific services and supports to meet the needs of children and their families. And these are services and supports that would not be available, that are not available through any other funding source. So without the appropriation of flux funds, these needs would go unmet. Independent research about the impact of flux funds has found many positive impacts. I want to provide a few examples, specific examples of how these services are used. Children are able to avoid foster care placements and safely remain with a parent by using flux funds. For example, flux funds have allowed children and a non-offending parent to leave a domestic violence situation and live safely. Also, flux-funded parent trainers have enabled parents to acquire the skills that they need to parent their children. These are parents who have not learned how to parent from their parents, and we are teaching them. They are capable, but they need to learn the skills. Visitation is another very important service that is facilitated and enhanced by flux funds. Professional literature indicates that visitation is essential to family reunification, reduces the time spent in foster care, and curtails children's behavioral problems. Flux funds are used, to enhance and facilitate visits, and in some counties, specifically we've talked to people in rural counties, transportation is a major barrier to children visiting their parents, siblings, or other relatives, and flux funds assist in those visits. For many of my clients, removing them to a safe situation is not enough. They need help and services to overcome the effects of abuse and neglect. For example, too many children enter foster care having experienced significant school absences due to family chaos and abuse and neglect. These are children who don't qualify for special education services because they don't have a disability. They've just been absent from school. For example, one little 9-year-old girl entered foster care Her mother had died of a drug overdose. She had been living for a couple of years with her father, moving from hotel to hotel, not going to school. When she entered foster care, a psychologist thought she was mildly mentally retarded. She was provided tutoring services that were paid for by flux funds, and she caught up to grade level. She was not mildly mentally retarded. She just did not have the skills. We had other clients who we represented who were, instead of attending school, they were out collecting cans for food and, unfortunately, to pay for their mother's alcohol. These clients were years behind in school. They received flux-funded tutoring services and did catch up and were successful. I have many clients who are unfortunately exposed to drugs or alcohol in utero.
Okay, can I stop you? We've been on you 4 minutes already. Amy, they're taking your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. And these stories are so important, and these clients are so important.
I agree with you.
And we are asking that the current allocation is not enough to meet the needs. And we do lay out in our overview of how much we think is an appropriate allocation. We ask this committee to consider raising the appropriation of flux funds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amy Miller, and thanks for letting me speak with you today. It's an honor to be here, and I'm a fast talker, so I will hopefully make up that minute that I have now lost.
No, you have not.
I'm here today to discuss in brief relative foster care, and in particular, financial support for relative foster parents. Relative foster care, you've undoubtedly heard by now, is good for children. Research from the Urban Institute has shown that children placed with relatives are more likely to stay in one place. In our experience representing children in Oregon, shows that children who undergo the most significant placement instability stay in foster care longer and utilize some of the most expensive services, including residential treatment. In addition to increased placement stability, children placed with relatives are also more likely to leave foster care successfully. They are 36% less likely to disrupt from an adoptive home, 35% less likely to disrupt from a permanent guardianship, and 34% less likely to experience a failed reunification with their parents. As you've also probably heard by now, in Oregon, we do not provide foster parents to all licensed and certified relative foster parents, foster payments to certified relative foster parents, only to those that qualify for federal funding. And we're one of two states which doesn't put relative and non-relative foster parents on equal footing with regard to these support payments. In Oregon, about 30% of our children in foster care are placed with relatives. We agree with DHS that relative foster parents should be eligible for monthly foster care payments, but we're opposed to the plan to support only some of these relatives. The plan creates a new disparity within the group of relative foster parents because only certain relatives would qualify for support payments. There are several problems with the proposal for relative foster care support. This is in the governor's budget. The first one is it's an inefficient use of public resources. In Oregon, the majority of our relative caregivers are older, they're often single, and a lot of times have one income. DHS looked at a sample of current relative foster parents who are not currently receiving foster care payments and found 80% of them had incomes below 150% of the federal poverty level. And all of them were below 300% of the federal poverty level. The current proposal that's in the governor's budget would cap foster care assistance to relatives at 150% of the FPL. And just to put that in context, this means that a single foster parent who agrees to care for her two grandchildren would receive no foster care payments if her income was more than $24,900. It makes no sense to create these additional eligibility parameters and administrative expense to manage eligibility when we already know that virtually all these caregivers will desperately need assistance to care for their kin. In addition, this proposal has negative impacts actually on all children who are placed in relative foster care. And the reason why is because undoubtedly it'll take some time to determine whether or not a relative would meet the low income standard that's required by the means test and be eligible for payments. During this time, relatives who want to be foster parents would likely be anxiously awaiting the news as to whether or not they qualify. And while relatives are waiting to see if they're able to afford to care for the kin, the children would likely be placed in non-relative foster care where they will be forced to adapt to a new environment and new people when they could have been directly placed with relatives. And on the other side, relative foster parents who might have taken on their kin in a rush to care for them when there was a need, without even considering whether or not they might be eligible, they might later be shocked to be found ineligible for support and may be forced to make some real tough decisions about how to make ends meet and care for their kids and what to do. And just really quick, in your packet, on the back of the second page, there's a graph that looks like this. It's a pretty simple one. It's a pie graph. The top section is basically DHS's proposal from the governor's budget, and it kind of splits up the different groups of children, where they're placed, and who would receive payments. Basically, the cost is about $2.7 million, and there'll be a means test, as I mentioned, at 150% of the FPL. This proposal will cover about 80% of non-paid relatives, and 5% will be left unpaid, which is about 1% of the children. And the Juvenile Rights Project has a bill, Senate Bill 282, and it would cost about $3.3 million to ensure that every foster parent would receive payment. There would be no complex eligibility determination. So for a difference of less than $700,000 on an annual basis, everybody can get paid. So I just want to bring that to your attention, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you.
Thank you
very, very much. Kathy Kaufman.
Yeah,
Ellen Lowe. Ann Euler. I know these ladies will help us out with 3 minutes, please, so we can hear everybody who came today.
Okay. Chair Carter and the members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today as legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, and you have my written testimony, and it really is a follow-up to what you just heard from Amy Miller, in that what I'm really asking you to do is, when you compute that bottom line in doing your budget on relative foster care, that you do what I call the net social and economic benefits. And as you reflect on what Amy said about the length of time that the children may be in foster care before there's reunification or there's adoption, the cost of doing the eligibility checking, even if you just looked at that bottom line, I can't imagine that there are savings in doing the means testing for relative foster care. The other costs are certainly the trauma to the child. And I can't imagine ever having to say no because of financial reasons. If I were faced with the opportunity to provide care for one of my or four grandchildren or all of them, and that should not be there for anyone to have to make that choice. But if you're just looking at the bottom line, I think you will still eliminate the means test. It does not make sense whether you spell that with a C or an S. Thank you.
Senator Carter and members of the committee, I'm Ann Wheeler. I'm the chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. I think all of you have received a copy of our domino effect, and if you don't have it handy, I'll be glad to get you another copy. The council, by statute, has to produce a report for the governor and for you every 2 years on the status of drug and alcohol treatment and prevention in the state of Oregon. One of the things that, two things out of this report that I want to bring your attention to today. The first, of course, is that as treatment access decreased over the last 4 years, foster care has increased. There's a direct relationship. In addition, something that you may not be aware of because it might not fall under your specific duties is the second thing out of the report I want to bring to your attention, and that's the report about the increase in the number of women that are going to prison. And that's also directly related to their drug abuse. In fact, 80% of them have a drug or alcohol problem, and 65% of them had custody of their children before they were incarcerated. So you can see that that has also impacted foster care. And, of course, other families have taken those children, not just foster care. But it's a, we have a direct relationship, and sometimes, and it is the job of the council to look at 15 different agencies and say, how has alcohol and drug affected all of these agencies? Sometimes we get very siloed into only looking at, well, this happened. But if we don't look at what happens at the beginning, that is access to drug and alcohol treatment, sometimes we don't see or and are not aware of all of the gradual impact of the rest of the state agencies. And in fact, the longer we wait, the more costly the treatment and the more costly to the state. A little catch-22 that I want you to understand that most people don't understand is if parents, mostly women, have their children taken away from them temporarily because of alcohol or drug abuse, they lose their health plan. Now, in order to get their children back, they have to have treatment. But when they lose their health care, then they can't get treatment. So they're caught in this catch-22. And so we all end up being caught in it by paying more money because their disease, what ends up happening is they go on long waiting lists for the few treatment dollars we have outside of the health plan. And as they wait, their disease becomes more and more severe. And so then it becomes more costly to treat them. So what we want to encourage you to do is to make sure that there's immediate access for all people who are at the risk of losing their children to treatment in order to cut down the cost all across all of the other state agencies that happen when we don't do that. And for three reasons, We ask you to do this. One is because it's certainly cheaper, and it's actually more effective to do that.
And let me have you wrap up.
Okay, I'm down to two or out of three. The preventative issue is when you treat the parent and the children in tandem, you're also reducing the chance of those children going on to become drug and alcohol addicted. And in fact, the vast majority of folks that are in treatment come from families who had drug and alcohol problems. And then third, it improves their quality of life. Eventually they become employed and pay taxes and pay back to the community. And I was going to tell you a small story, but it sounds like I don't have the time to do that. So thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Eleanor Ways. Terry Quintels, Sarah Beth Laberton.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, my name is Terry Quintos. I'm the Program Director of Crime Survivors for Community Safety. We're a program of Partnership for Safety and Justice located in Portland. I come to you today as someone who has done direct service in domestic and sexual violence programs since 1989 in the state of Oregon in various programs, including the state based coalition. And I want to talk to you today about the Department of Human Services. The Children, Adults, and Family Division administers about $2.8 million from the criminal fines assessment accounts to nonprofit agencies that deliver services to domestic and sexual violence survivors, such as emergency shelter. And this funding is distributed to about 50 programs in all 36 counties in the state of Oregon. And there is a nexus between the Department of Human Services Child Welfare and these programs that provide services. And that is that keeping parents safe in turn helps keep children safe. This funding in Oregon is severely inadequate. Last year alone in Oregon, over 8,000 victims were turned away from emergency shelter services when they tried to receive help because of a lack of resources. And statistics tell us that almost half of them had at least one child with them. We recognize that you are going to hear many compelling requests for very few dollars, and we respectfully request that you consider the following: that as a society that we recognize that domestic violence is a public health epidemic, and that as a society we have begun to ask victims of domestic and sexual violence to come forward and take action in helping to protect themselves and their children. And we also recognize that when someone is leaving an abusive relationship, that that is the time that they are most likely to be severely physically injured or possibly even murdered. In Oregon, what we know is that a non-offending parent can actually lose custody of their child if they are deemed to be failing to protect their child, and that includes living in an abusive home. And yet when 8,000 people tried to leave their abusive home last year, they couldn't get into emergency shelter services because there just was not enough space. And so that leaves people in a really tight predicament. They either have the option of going back to an abusive home, or they have another option of becoming homeless, and neither of those actually would be seen by child welfare as protecting their children adequately. So, and this happens across the state, both in rural and urban communities as well as the coastal regions. So we just want you to consider the fact that these services actually save lives, much like many of the services that you've heard today, and we recognize that, and that they also make a good economic and human impact sense.
Thank you. Chair Carter, member of the committee. I am Sarah Labberton. I'm an advocate with Women's Crisis Service here in Marion County. We have been serving victims of domestic and sexual violence for 33 years. I just want to reiterate what Terry said today. As you'll see in my written testimony, we have some facts and figures. The one thing I'd like to call your attention to is the fact that over half of our shelter stay nights are children. We serve 300 to 500 women and children every year. And in fact, today we have 4 single women, 3 moms, and 8 children staying at our shelter. And most of them are just from the Marion County area. So as you see, there is a great need for these services. And I'll just let you read the testimony for the rest of the information. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Arthur Towers, Barbara Casey. Pronounced somebody's name wrong.
Yeah. Senator Carter and the Roosevelt Committee, For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, a political director for SEIU Local 503. I have with me today 3 frontline child welfare workers, and I'd just like them to have the opportunity to tell their story.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman and the rest of the committee. My name is Barbara Casey. I work for the Department of Human Services and Child Welfare at the Midtown Branch. I'm an SSS1, a caseworker that currently right now is in foster parent certification and recruitment. And I am here probably to reiterate many of the same points that Senator Fowley already made, so I'll try not to reiterate. But I do want to say we certainly applaud the goals of DHS to lower caseloads, to have consistent practices, and to increase ability to use more social work. We just feel that the elimination, or at least the having of SSAs, really counterpoints those exact goals. In terms of lowering caseload, that is a very, very different effect than lowering workload. Lowering caseload for a caseworker to possibly 1 to 15 children in care, when you think about visitation possibly taking between 3, 4, 5 hours per child, because we know that visitation supports reunification, you're talking about a work week of possibly 45 hours. It's just not possible for a caseworker to do that. In terms of the consistency, there is no way that a caseworker could honestly go out and say to a child, I will definitely be there to pick you after school at Saban School every Thursday at 3. There's just too many other constraints on a caseworker's schedule to be able to do that. And I want you to think about the 2 worst days of any parent's life, the day that their child are removed and the day that they have to appear in court to hear the allegations, and then have to turn around to that same caseworker and say, oh, yes, I trust you completely. Tell me what to do. It's that SSA that is there to be able to say, we want to schedule a visit with your child. I'm available. And, you know, we have a wonderful caseworker in Ted Frank who works at the juvenile court to make sure that parents can get back after that horrific day to pick themselves up, and it's the SSA that partners with the caseworkers. And so we are very, very concerned that the expertise, the training, the partnership, that collaborative effect will be lost. We applaud the caseload reduction, but it would certainly make a very, very big workload, and in the best interest of the child, the more visits we have, as we know that this is the SSA is a very, very strong partner in that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Kathy Granger, and I'm with the Gresham GHS office. I am an SSA. I've been with the agency since 1980, and I provide weekly visitation for 12 to 15 families during a 40-hour work week. I work a flexible work schedule, and sometimes Saturdays and tonight until 7:30. What I can tell you is that as far as safety for children is concerned, SSAs have some training that no one else in the agency has. We have CPR and first aid training. We have infant heart monitor training. And part of our job is to keep that up to date. The reason that that's important is because when kids come into our agency, it's often on an emergency basis. And when parents are dealing with the police and having their children removed and all of the emotional kinds of things that go along with that, they often don't provide complete medical history on their children. We don't always know what the child's medical needs are when we're transporting them, when we're supervising a visit. And so it's important to know how to handle situations that arise. That's training that if caseworkers were doing visits, they would need in addition to the training that they already have. Also, Barbara brought up that it's often the caseworker that is seen in court and that is seen as not a friend initially. You know, they come into the child's life and the parent's life during a really difficult time. And then to have to do a visit where the children and the parents are brought together, and you want that to be a pleasant time. You don't want the animosity of that emergency situation and that court involvement to impact that child. I can redirect that a whole lot easier than a caseworker can, even though we have caseworkers that have excellent people skills. Just by being not the person who's involved in making the case plan. I think that pretty much wraps it up. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Cochran. I'm a child welfare permanency worker, so I work with children who have come into foster care through the time that they're either able to reunify with their parents or they're adopted or placed into a guardianship or some other permanent plan. And while I'm also excited about the agency's proposal and their goals to work towards reducing workload for caseworkers so that they can be more dedicated to meeting the needs of children and families, I am concerned about the elimination of the SSA position. I see it as the SSAs and the caseworkers partnering in a complementary way to work with families together. When the SSAs do the visits, it frees up the caseworkers to be able to have other meaningful face-to-face contact with children and families. As I testified to earlier, unfortunately, with the nature of our work, the relationship between parents and caseworkers can be contentious. An example is I supervise visits when an SSA is not available if they're sick. and I was supervising a visit between two children and their mom, and the child asked me at the end of the visit, "Why does my mom hate you so much?" And we noticed that she'd been anxious during the visit, and she just picked up on her mother's anxiety. And visitation is such an important time between a child and their parent, and they really shouldn't have to be worried about what's going on with their caseworker and the parent, or picking up on those vibes from the parent that they're, you know, they're anxious about something. It really takes away from what is supposed to be happening at the visit. I think one of the nice things is by partnering with SSAs, they do the visits. I'm able to do that kind of interaction. I can meet with the parent. I can go over the safety reasons that the child's into care and really work to support them towards accessing services, to be able to get their child back and to understand what their child's needs are. I'm able to meet with children on a regular basis, to help support them, to get to know them, to make life storybooks with them, putting pictures together with their families, to help them understand why they're in care, and what they need to feel safe. And I think if my time was devoted to supervising visits, where we can't have that kind of interaction, it would really take away from that critical need to be able to interact with both the parents and children in the way that caseworkers can. So I definitely support more staffing, so that we have more time to do that kind of interaction. But I think that the SSAs play a complementary role in allowing caseworkers to have the important, unique interactions that they do.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
John Lowen.
Senator, I'd just like to add one quick point.
Very quick.
What's going on in the Capitol is a very positive thing. There's more requirements that are being put on each case. And so as that happens, the caseworkers will have a lot more things to do and a lot more reports. That's, you know, generally a positive thing in terms of watching out for child abuse and things like that. But having the two sets of eyes per case is really was compelling to me as I learned more about this situation. That you have two sets of eyes per case, make it better for the family, make it better for the children, and make it much more likely that we'll catch the various challenges that we're facing. With that, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Diane Fox and Melinda Fleming. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I think I can do my testimony in about a minute. Just a couple of things that I want to talk about very quickly about workload issues within CAF. There have been a number of discussions about that today. We're supportive of adding staff in critical areas in CAF, and would also point out that legal consultation and representation is important in the system, but it doesn't necessarily lessen the workload, so we would draw some attention to that. We also want to be on the record about the relative adult foster home situation and eliminating the means test. A third point I would make, which is something I haven't heard today, is about aging out of foster care and the concern and the startling number about the number of people who wind up homeless after being in foster care. So we would like some attention to that particular issue. And then finally, my colleague Sybil Hepp could not be here today. She apologizes for that, but she has some excellent written testimony on the criminal fines and assessment account, which you heard some about already today. And just her conclusion is that she references a 2006 study that was done by DHS that recommends that a minimum of $5 million of new funds is needed to sustain this system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Sybil did come in my office and talk to me yesterday, so she's not going to be able to be here.
Madam Chair and members, this is my first time up here, so I'm very nervous. My name is Melinda Fleming, and I am a adoptive mother of four through the foster care system, and we're working on number five. I'm also the community resource coordinator for the local Marion Pope Foster Parent Association, and I'm a very strong advocate for foster care and adoption. The first point that I want to make is about the special rates, and I hear that those might be leaving, and I want to say no, please really think about it. Basically, what that special rate does, and I have a child in my home that I've had now that we're working on adopting since July of 2005, I have no medical diagnoses for her. I can tell you she's got lots of problems, but
until those are actually diagnosed, which they're still not, I count on that special rate because she is a high needs kid. I spend more time with her than the whatever normal child would be, which I expect to. But I also pay more for her clothes because she wears out the knees. She's growing very fast. Special toys when these kids don't have that diagnosis and you know they have sensory issues, but you don't have the diagnosis. When you get a normal to foster care rate for those kids, you're taking it out of your pocket for those kind of things because there is no flex funds and there's no things like that for right now. I think it's very important that we don't take that special rate away. We're already losing foster parents now. I can only imagine, and again, we're not in it for the money. You hear that from people. But these are, every single child that comes in from the foster care system is a special needs kid. I have two twin boys that we got at the age of 5, and they're 15 now, and I could go on and on about all the kind of special needs that they have. So it's just very, very important that we don't lose that. We don't take it away. It's very, very important. The other is the caseworker overload, and I'm hearing that the SSAs are the part that's going to be lost. I don't know anything about that, but regarding the caseworker overload, they are completely overworked. There is no way that they can maintain, as foster and adoptive parents, you can't maintain a teamwork mentality with them if you never can see them or get a hold of them. And I think it's very important for these kids that we're able to get them what the child needs. We need to be able to spend more time with those caseworkers for them to get to know us and the child in the home. And 1 hour a month, if it actually happens that often, which it's supposed to, it's not enough. It's not enough time. And then one thing I'd like to bring up that we used to have was employer-related daycare. I know that we had a lot of foster parents, good foster parents. If we had that again, we would probably have a lot more foster parents. I stay home because I can't afford, with 5 kids, to go to work. But if I could, I maybe would do it a couple of days a week. I think it's really important. I think we would maintain some foster homes if we could help financially. You know, if this is a community problem, and we need to figure out a way to help these kids and help these families. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if this is the first time you've ever testified, I want you testifying on all my bills.
Good. I'll be talking to you later then.
You've done good.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Diana Fox. I'm president of the Women's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Issues in Oregon, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of HB 5031. The mission of the Women's Commission is to increase public awareness of women's alcohol and drug issues and to promote services related to women throughout the state of Oregon. The commission is made up of representatives from across Oregon who have many years of experience in the treatment of women. We know that treatment works. We have collectively seen countless numbers of women recover and reunite with their children, become capable parents, as well as wage earners and taxpayers. It's often these women that we also find giving back to their communities through involvement as treatment professionals. Hope I'm talking fast enough. Volunteers and advocates. In each region of the state, though, we share the same concern, and that's a lack of access to adequate treatment to serve those women who have been threatened with the loss of their children or have...
I bet you could tell us in your own, without even reading that. Talk to us.
I can... Okay, I will tell you
that. I bet you have that kind of compassion. I hear it.
Okay, I will say that, again, across the state of Oregon, we have a concern that there just is not enough funded outpatient treatment for women. Mm-hmm. Which is important because, of course, catching a woman when they're early in their disease, outpatient often works for them. There is also not enough money in the funded outpatient programs to really adequately give them the intensity of services that they need. More importantly, and I think the one that probably strongly affects women who have children in foster care is that we need more residential beds for women and for children. There is just, again, across the state, there's just not enough of those. We find that women coming into that level of care often were often parented in families where there was multi-generational use of alcohol and drugs. And so they're coming into a residential treatment program where they are then acquiring parenting skills through parenting classes, through modeling of staff and peers and so forth. And they need a longer period of time in order to solidify those skills that they're acquiring. So the Women's Commission asks that you continue to keep a focus on providing an increase in funding for these types of services, which we, which in my written testimony also I go through how, of course, that does reduce the cost, to society.
Absolutely.
Treatment is effective in doing that. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys, and thanks everybody for coming today. And another committee has to meet here. That's why we usually are putting that at 2:30. But I felt strongly that we should not let a citizen come in and not be heard today. Thank you, committee, for staying later today and everything. Committee dismissed.
Joint Committee on Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. It's Thursday, February 22nd, 2007, 3 p.m. in Hearing Room F.